It's Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. We're coming to you today from a new location, my town. That's right, I'm broadcasting from WAMU in Washington, D.C., and it's good to be home. Today, it's all about the Senate, the world's most exclusive club. That's how the United States Senate was described in William White's seminal book Citadel in 1957. Lots of people used to want the gig. It's a coveted title. But when we fast forward to 2019, well, the candidate field on the Democratic side is a little more like this. It seems like everyone who's anyone is running away from the Senate. Stacey Abrams, the Democrat who narrowly lost the race for governor of Georgia in 2018, was a major recruiting target for Senate Democrats. I asked her about her future campaign plans on this show back in February.
If you want to announce anything, you can do that right now.
I appreciate the opportunity, but...
Running for Senate?
I have not made a decision. It will be the end of March.
Okay. Oh. All right. Well, let's move on.
Nice try. Very nice try.
I know. Yeah. It was really subtle. Okay.
And well, her decision came not at the end of March. It was the end of April. And to the great disappointment of Democrats, it was a no. And Stacey Abrams isn't the only one. There's Congressman Joaquin Castro in Texas. Nope. Ambassador Susan Rice in Maine. Nope. Congresswoman Sidney Axne and former Governor Tom Vilsack of Iowa.
No. No. No.
Not today.
No. I get it.
And then there are the folks who've opted to run for president instead of running for the Senate. John Hickenlooper, the former governor of Colorado, and of course, Beto O'Rourke, who rose to prominence in 2018 when he challenged Texas Senator Ted Cruz. So why is the Senate not getting much love? Well, an institution once known as the cooling saucer these days feels more like a hot mess. The partisanship is deeper and more entrenched than ever, and gridlock fills the gaps on pretty much everything.
Case closed.
Still, given how frustrated Democrats are with the actions taken by Mitch McConnell and how much they want to beat President Trump in 2020, it is surprising that so many top-tier candidates have been opting out. Over the last few months, I've been talking with top Democratic strategists, and they say winning the White House and control of the Senate in 2020 is critical.
It's going to be just as difficult for the next president to look at Mitch McConnell as it is for this president to look at Nancy Pelosi. They have a lot of power. I mean, we're starting to find that out.
That, of course, is the raging Cajun, James Carville.
At the end of the day, power is the only thing that matters. We want to be right. We want to be noble. We want to be this, and we should. If you don't win, it doesn't know any good.
So having the White House and the House isn't enough for Democrats.
Well, it's good to look. It's better than we were in 2016, but you're not going to be able to do anywhere near in terms of judicial appointments. And I don't dislike Mitch McConnell. I mean, I've counted him 3 or 4 times, but I know exactly what's going to happen. And it's not going to be good.
It's not going to be good.
And if we don't have somebody, if Democrats don't think Mitch McConnell when they vote, they better, because we got a lot of people, we got a lot of Senate seats, and you look at the Senate map, and it's not none of them easy.
Jim Messina, who was President Obama's campaign manager in 2012, didn't hesitate when I asked him about his Senate philosophy.
Sit back.
Yes.
Take some
everybody.
Time. I'm about to go on a Jim Messina rant. Look, I worked in the United States Senate for 13 years before Barack Obama gave me the greatest job of my life. And I think if you look at 2009, 2010 legislative achievements of Barack Obama, they're historically big. And they were historically big because he had control of both the House and the Senate. And I think if you look at what's likely to occur in the House, Democrats are likely to retain the House. And so if you're a Democrat and think we beat Donald Trump, then you have to have the Senate. And if you look at legislative achievements, if you had to have either chamber, you'd want the Senate, because the Senate is where good bills go to die. And so it's no fun if a new Democratic president comes in and Speaker Pelosi is sitting there ready to pass the agenda and we can't get through the Senate. So we've got to win Senate seats.
And Messina makes another interesting point about some of the people running for president.
Some of these people who are running for president actually aren't running for president. They think they are. They're raising money for it. But they're actually running for cabinet positions, or they're running to be on the ticket. I will pick on him because he's one of my close friends. He's my former roommate. But the governor of Montana, Steve Bullock, whom I love, who is running for president should run for Senate. He would win that election, but he wants to be president of the United States. And so he's running. John Hickenlooper is another great example. John Hickenlooper is the one politician who could beat Cory Gardner. In a presidential year, we didn't win any Senate seats in places where Hillary Clinton didn't win. So if you start to look at some of these places, Colorado is one of them, Arizona is another one, Montana would be the opposite of this if we can do it. But you've got to nominate really good candidates in some of these places. Colorado, and I might say Montana, are states where you can hold on that decision and you can go to the first debates and you can do some stuff, see how you're doing, get into the summer, eat some Iowa Fair food, which is the best food around, and then make some decisions.
I've had the Iowa Fair food, and the pork chop on a stick is fantastic, but the fried butter, not so much. Anyway, his bigger point is this. Just because a lot of potential Senate candidates are running for president now, or even have said no, doesn't mean we should count them out. There's a long time between the first presidential debates and primaries and the filing deadlines for many of these Senate contests. That's what happened back in 2016 with Senator Marco Rubio. After an unsuccessful bid for president, he went on to run for re-election, even after saying publicly he wasn't going to do so. So to get a clear sense of the map and whether this recruiting drought is a big problem for Democrats or if we're just making too much of it, I brought in my colleague at the Cook Political Report, Jennifer Duffy, who's an expert on all things Senate campaigns.
This battleground is a little bit deceptive. So in 2018, you had Democrats defending more seats. They were defending seats in very red states. And the presumption in this cycle was that the tables are turned, right? It's now Republicans defending 22 seats, Democrats defending 12. But what's missing from that math is that you don't have any Republicans sitting in a very blue state. In fact, you have a few Republicans sitting in marginal states. Yet Democrats still have one of their incumbents sitting in a solidly red state, which is Doug Jones in Alabama, which really makes him the most vulnerable incumbent up this time. So we don't have that sort of red, blue, and blue fight we had last cycle. And that's what, at least to me, makes the hill to a Democratic majority a little bit steeper.
Right. That's what I want to get into, which is how would that work for Democrats to take the majority? What do they need to do?
Okay. Well, if they win the White House, they need 3 seats, a net gain of 3. If Republicans retain the White House, they need 4. So this early in the cycle, I'm a big favorite of simple math. A lot of people just assume that they will lose Alabama. That Democrats will lose Alabama. I'm not ready to make that assumption yet, only because, you know, I was around for the 17 special election. You could see how badly things got. But there are 3 very clear Republican targets. Martha McSally in Arizona, Cory Gardner in Colorado, and Susan Collins in Maine. But that's not enough. Even if they win Alabama, they'd have to win those 3 and the White House to get a majority, and it'd be a 50-50 majority. What they need to do is expand the playing field. So we've heard a lot of talk about Georgia, certainly Stacey Abrams' rather public contemplation about whether she was going to run for the Senate, swallowed a lot of oxygen. North Carolina, I think, is another place that they're going to try and find a candidate, and Iowa is the 3rd. So if they put those 6 seats on the board, they have a much better shot at the majority. Now, Republicans kind of have the same problem, right? Right now, the only obvious target is Alabama. So what they're going to try and do is put Michigan, Gary Peters, perhaps New Hampshire on the board, maybe Minnesota. You know, in a presidential year, those will all be very interesting states. But the question is, you know, whether they can find the candidate to do it.
So there have been a lot of stories in recent weeks about the challenge Democrats have had. Chuck Schumer, who is the recruiter in chief for the Democrats, the minority leader, has been unable to get the top tier candidates in some of these states, like, for example, Georgia, which you mentioned, but Texas, Beto O'Rourke not running, Joaquin Castro, brother of Julian, congressman, right. He's not running. no big name yet in Colorado or Maine. Are Democrats in trouble?
No, they're not in trouble. First of all, you know, I hate to use this analogy because it's so overdone, but the whole recruiting process is a little bit like sausage making. You know, it probably all tastes good in the end, but you really don't want to watch it happen. This has been an unusually transparent recruiting cycle, especially for the DSCC, which tends to keep its cards pretty close to the vest until they have candidates. And, you know, they are masters at clearing primary fields. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of that is done through recruiting the strongest candidate and then talking everybody else out of the race. For some reason, this has not been the case this cycle. But I think that if you're sort of a connoisseur of recruiting and you've watched it cycle after cycle, like the two of us have, you learn that there are some big name candidates mentioned who are serious and those who are not serious. I mean, they talk a lot about, you know, Governor Hickenlooper in Colorado saying that he wouldn't run. He never had any interest in running for the Senate. And I give him this, is that he made it so he can't change his mind. I mean, the things that he has said is, you know, a gift to any Republican media consultant. We talk about Texas. I don't think Beto O'Rourke was ever serious about running against John Cornyn. John Cornyn's all that vulnerable. I think Castro is a bigger hit. I'm sure that they would have liked a Hispanic candidate there. There are things that surprise me, though. One, Maine. So after the Kavanaugh vote, there were lots of Democrats in a few independents ready to sort of march Susan Collins' head around the Capitol Hill on a stake. Mm-hmm. And you heard people like Susan Rice say that she was very serious about running. There were other names floated out there. There was somebody who went out and raised over $3 million to be used against her in a campaign. And here we are. There is not an announced candidate. Susan Rice has taken herself out of the running. You know, I think that there was a play for Congressman Shelley Pingree to run, and she is not going to do it, although her daughter, who was a former State House Speaker, may run. The current State House Speaker, Sarah Gideon, may run. But it's not the big race that everybody was gearing up for last fall. And finally, Colorado. So one of the things that Democrats, Senate Democrats, are known for is their ability to clear primary fields. They don't like primaries. They think that it damages their ultimate nominee. And especially in a state like Colorado, who, one, has an interesting nomination process that goes through caucuses and then a primary, and the primary isn't until August. Right now, there are 10 announced candidates, and 5 of them are credible. So while I jokingly say that this is Schumer's own version of Survivor, it's not all that far off. The attitude about Colorado right now is that there is not an obvious front runner. There are some potentially very solid candidates here. So the feeling is, okay, everybody get in the pool and show us you can swim.
And then we'll go from there.
Right. We'll go from there. We will look at this after the third quarter, maybe at the end of the year. They don't seem to be in that big a hurry, but it is just not the way they usually operate.
So you're not willing, like some others, to say Democrats are in a deep hole because of
I don't think
recruiting.
Democrats are in a deep hole, but here's where their speed bump is right now. That need to expand the playing field to places like Iowa, Georgia, North Carolina, that's where their struggle is right now.
Let's talk about 2018 and what lessons you took from that, especially about whether geography is indeed destiny.
In some ways, we learned that geography was destiny, but not in a vacuum, right? You couldn't beat somebody with a terrible candidate. You were not going to go into West Virginia and beat Joe Manchin with the candidate they nominated, Patrick Morrissey, because believe it, even though he'd been elected statewide, to run for the Senate or to run for governor is a huge step up. It's a different ballgame. And not everybody's, even if they've been elected statewide, is ready for that. And Patrick Morrissey clearly wasn't. You know, John Tester has found the perfect sort of mix of populism and sort of some core Democratic values that moves him past party labels.
Right. So this is how two Democrats can win in states that Trump right. carried by double digits.
Right, exactly. So there were five states that Trump carried by 19 points or more. Republicans won three of them. Then again, they also won one of the states that was sort of even in Florida. But, you know, Democrats picked up some sort of marginal seats. Arizona, you know, a state that Trump won by four. I think the other thing the Democrats took away, and this is kind of what we're seeing the repercussions of this now, is that, look, I don't know if they could have had a better candidate in Tennessee than Phil Bredesen. I can't imagine who that would be. And he fell way short of what he needed to do. And I think there's still a lot of head scratching going on about Texas. But they do know that part of Beto O'Rourke's success was really Ted Cruz's weaknesses, which didn't get nearly as much attention as Beto, you know, skateboarding around Whataburger parking lots. So I think they're still digesting that. My sense is that, of course, they'd like to win Texas and they'd like to win Kentucky, but that is not in their grand plan. They would, however, like to keep Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, and John Cornyn, a member of the leadership, very occupied this cycle, so they don't have time to do things like raise money for their colleagues, campaign for other people. So, you know, they're happy. I call them distraction races, and they're happy to have those.
There's a whole lot of attention, obviously, on the 2020 Democratic primary field, but you talk to a lot of Democrats and they say, what we're worried about is not enough attention, money, donor support is going to the Senate races. And quite frankly, they say, it's not enough to just win the White House and have the House. If Mitch McConnell is still the majority leader, the Democrat who wins the White House won't get anything done. Do you sense that there is, that the Senate's getting overlooked by people who should be donating, getting folks energized, clearing out fields, recruiting good candidates?
I'm not sure it's getting ignored, but when I looked at the first quarter FEC numbers, I thought that Democratic fundraising, with the possible exception of Mark Kelly in Arizona, who sort of hit it out of the park, was kind of down across the board. Mm-hmm. And then I looked at an article that just looked at cash on hand and found out that it was only down $6 million. But the fundraising, the contributions itself were a little bit down. And that I do attribute to the presidential race. Mm-hmm. I mean, this field raised $95 million. I mean, that's a lot of attention. I think that there was a lot of expectations that, at least among Democrats, that they were going to do better than they did. But part of your statement that there are a lot of people who feel that if Democrats don't have the Senate, even if they have the White House, things are bad. But look, this is where the Senate's a different beast. Even if they have the majority, it will maybe 50 seats, 51 seats. That's not what we call a working majority. We don't think McConnell has a working majority. He can certainly stall things and he can get judges through, but they can't really do anything else. So I don't think Democrats winning a Senate majority is the key to a Democratic president being able to get anything done.
Talk to us, too, about 2016 and what we learned. Again, geography being destiny and the top of the ticket, the presidential candidate's performance, because this is true, right? There's not one Senate candidate who won in a state that that candidate's presidential nominee did not win.
Right. I mean, yes, I think that that's true. And that was even more so across the board in the Senate. Governors had some exceptions, mm-hmm. though, which I thought was kind of interesting, going back to Montana. But I think that this should be Democrats' biggest concern right now, is that their second tier of Republican targets are either in swing states or in marginally Republican states, which makes it hard. I mean, if Trump carries Iowa, does Joni Ernst lose? If he carries Georgia, even if it's, he won by 8 points, even if he carries it by four, does David Perdue lose? But the other thing that, you know, you sort of have to keep in check is you still have to run good campaigns.
Right. Is your sense that the quality of the candidate is as important today as it was back in the old days when we first started doing this, when voters were seemed to be more willing to split their ticket between a presidential candidate and congressional candidate?
Well, in that regard, yes. But you've sort of asked a trick question. Because I think overall, over the last 6 or 8 years, the quality of candidate on both sides has gone down.
Why is that?
Well, because I don't think the Senate is the fun place it used to be. You know, I think that, you know, people don't go to the Senate to enjoy gridlock. But, you know, especially if you're a former governor, right? We always call that the most frustrated group of people in the Senate, former governors, because they're used to getting things done. Now they're saying, no, thanks. I mean, that's one part of it. The other part of it, of course, is that campaigns are expensive and they're nasty. And a lot of people feel like they can use their energies in a different way than putting themselves and their families through that. So I think that's true. But I still think candidates are important. I mean, I do think that there are places that we've seen candidates sneak up and they, you know, they may not win, but they come close. And the interesting one from 2018 was Michigan, which almost nobody paid attention to. That the Republican John James got very little attention, although the president liked him. He went out there for him twice. But it wasn't until the end of last year that even I appreciated he raised $12.7 million and came within 3 points of beating Debbie Stabenow in a race nobody was paying attention right. to. So you do have to watch those things.
Those sorts of things. Jennifer Duffy, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Let's take a step back a second, all the way back. Why do we have a Senate anyway?
The purpose of the Senate, the original idea, was that bicameral legislatures worked better. This is sort of a presupposition that the framers of the Constitution had.
That's Frances Lee, a political science professor at the University of Maryland.
They're thinking on the British model. And so they thought the Senate should be something like the House of Lords. One of their big problems was that there's no aristocracy in the United States to be represented in the House of Lords, but the Senate should be something like that.
So how did they decide how many senators there should be? It turns out that question was hotly debated in 1787 at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia.
The convention broke down into two blocks, with one group of delegates favoring Senate representation on the basis of population, and another group favoring equal state representation. This was the one issue that almost caused the convention to break up without reaching a successful draft of the Constitution. Madison, Hamilton were not in favor of giving each state equal representation in the Senate, but they lost, and they didn't walk out.
Since then, a lot of changes have been made to the Senate. For example, originally, senators were elected by state legislatures, but in 1913, the 17th Amendment was ratified, declaring that senators would be elected by popular vote. Plus, the Senate has grown with the addition of new states, like Alaska.
Once Russian America, then Seward's Folly, now becoming the newest state in the Union, Alaska.
And Hawaii.
Aloha means both farewell and greetings, and Hawaii bids farewell to 40 years of frustration and failure in attempts to win statehood.
But despite all these changes over the centuries, the two senators per state rule has not been touched.
That's one part of the Constitution that might not be changeable by a regular constitutional amendment. Article 5 of the Constitution says that no state shall be denied its equal representation in the Senate except by its consent. So in other words, every state would have to agree. That's a higher bar than we have for amending the Constitution. We have to have a supermajority to amend the Constitution, but not unanimity among the states. This hasn't been litigated in the federal courts. It would be a question whether you could amend it, that part of the Constitution, with the regular way.
And that's a question that most senators aren't interested in asking, really.
More states benefit from equal representation than don't. You couldn't even get a majority of states to support moving away from equal state representation. And of course, in the regular constitutional amendment process, you would need a supermajority of states to agree to do it. It's very hard to see. It's just not in the interests of most states to concede on that.
It's also a question that Frances Lee says it seems like most people aren't interested in asking either.
It's actually quite interesting to me the extent to which the American public accepts equal state representation in the Senate as fair. even though it's grossly departs from the principle of one person, one vote, is not something that upsets people. I sort of find it funny when I go to the National Christmas Tree exhibit at the Ellipse, you'll see the big national tree in the middle, and then all around, one little Christmas tree for each state, all equal-sized. Like, it's just funny to think that, you know, you'd put North Dakota and South Dakota on equal footing with Texas and California, but we do, and the public accepts that it's right to treat all states equally.
That's Frances Lee, a political science professor at the University of Maryland. But has the time come for us to rethink how we're represented in the Senate? Two voices on that up ahead. Hey, folks, I've got some news to share. We're coming up on 1 year that I've been hosting Politics with Amy Walter on The Takeaway, and we want to celebrate. That's right. We're going to broadcast this show, Politics with Amy Walter, from WNYC's The Green Space in New York City on Friday, May 31st at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. If you're not in New York, that's okay. We'll be live streaming the show, so don't worry. And the conversation, it will be all about the Electoral College. You can get a peek into what it takes to make the show. The event is free, but you need to reserve your tickets in advance. So visit thegreenspace.org/events to secure your seat. That's green, spelled G-R-E-E-N-E. We'll see you there. It's Politics with Amy Walter. Acetawinevu is a staff writer at The New Yorker covering politics and policy in Washington, D.C. Logan Dobson is a Republican strategist and is the former director of data and analytics for the National Republican Senatorial Committee. And they both have pretty different opinions about making changes to the rules and structures of the U.S. Senate. Thank you both for coming in and joining me. Acita, I want to start with you. I know you've written a lot about this, so I'm going to ask you the question, is the Senate working?
No, the Senate is not working. I think it's important to sort of separate out the partisan struggle right now and the fact that the parties can't agree, which is not necessarily a feature of the Senate, from like the actual abstract design, which is why I think we're to talk about. I think that the Senate was designed in a bad way. I think we tell ourselves certain stories that the founders came together during the convention and thought that this was sort of the best way to go about things, and it's not true. There was a lot of disagreement about this at the convention. In fact, two of the most well-regarded founding fathers, including Madison, the father of the Constitution, explicitly said during the convention that the equal apportionment within the upper house was going to be a bad idea. Hamilton called it a destructive ingredient. It said it shocked too much the ideas of justice and every human feeling. Madison called it a confessedly unjust principle. And when it actually did pass, I believe it only passed the convention by one vote very narrowly. In a preview of what the Senate would be like, it only passed because each state was granted equal representation at the convention. The states that voted against it were, the population collectively was twice the size of the states that voted for it. And it's a design that has only become more dramatic in its impact on our politics with time. The population of California is 67 times the population of Wyoming, meaning effectively that a citizen in Wyoming has 67 times the say in the Senate of a citizen in California. That doesn't really make very much sense to me, and I think it's going to be even more of a problem as we think that the population of the country is going to be skewed in a way that gives, I believe, 30% of the population 70% of the seats in the Senate by 2040.
All right. Logan, what about you? Do you think there are structural problems then with the Senate that need to be reformed?
No. The Senate is working more or less as designed. I mean, if you go back and read, this is potentially too nerdy to get into, but the Federalist Papers, 62 and 63, written by James Madison about the Senate and its structure and the importance of having equal representation of the states, they discuss that it's very important because our government is not just a mob of people who are on the continent of North America governed by one central being. We are, in fact, the United States of America, and states sometimes have different interests than just the conglomeration of all of the people in the country would have spread about the geography. Just in terms of sort of the impact that the Senate has on modern day politics, you might, sort of listening to the people who disparage the Senate, who say, oh, well, you know, this is obviously skewing things in our politics one way or the other, you might believe that, well, the Senate is impossibly biased in favor of the Republican Party and against the Democrats, mm-hmm. because, you know, obviously the Democrats are all from the big states. But I went last night, and this is admittedly a hand tally, but I'm pretty sure I got it correct. If you look at the 10 largest states in America, do you know what the breakdown is of the senators from the 10 largest states in America? It's 10 Republicans and 10 Democrats. If you go look at the 10 smallest states in America, do you know what the breakdown is among the senators from the 10 smallest states in America? It's 10 Republicans and 10 Democrats. And so the Senate is designed to be a cooling saucer. It's designed to slow bills down. It's designed to not let the hot house pass through anything that they want to at any given moment. And in that sense, it's working exactly as designed. And it's provided for a remarkable amount of partisan balance, which I think is a good influence in our politics today.
Osita, Logan just made this point that, look, at the end of the day, this all sort of balances out because small states are represented by Democrats, big states are represented by Republicans. In the end, it all works out.
Oh, I disagree because, sure, the current balance of the small states and large states looks like it's pretty even. But if you look at the past 20 years of the senators who have represented the 10 smallest states, a majority of them have been Republican. But as I said before, I think it's important to sort of separate out partisan differences from the basic structural design. And even if it were the case that Republicans and Democrats represented small states and large states equally, that wouldn't solve the basic question of whether the small states, irrespective of what party dominates in them, should have a disproportionate amount of power to their size. The Senate was granted equal representation not because there was some abstract theory that they thought was best, but because the situation meant that they could only ratify the Constitution if they got the small states on board. And you had some small state representatives very candidly during the convention saying, look, we are looking out for our own interests right. here. And, you know, I think that people should think about that and sort of decide for themselves whether we have the system that we have as a consequence of some abstract theoretical way of thinking about the way government should be designed, or was this a situation that was created out of political necessity?
But isn't that then the whole point of the American system in and of itself, which was it was created, many of the compromises in the Constitution and right. that we continue to grapple with right now are just that, they're compromises. Trying to keep a really big, really diverse country together is really hard.
It is. I would argue it's even harder when some citizens have 67 times the say of other citizens. I think that makes people really mad, and I think that's why we're talking about this issue. I think this is a situation, as the skew becomes more drastic, that people are going to no longer want to abide by. We have this myth that this is a center-right country. I think it's a center-left country with a political system designed to routinely produce center-right outcomes. And I think it's true that, you know, the Senate does provide a counterbalance to the House, which is a proportional body. But a situation in which 30% of the population has 70% of the seats is more than a counterbalance. That is effectively giving a minority of the population a veto power within the legislative system. We're far beyond the Senate being this sort of bulwark and balancing part of the system that prevents mob rule. We're moving into a tyranny of the minority situation. And I think that people who defend the Senate have to take that seriously.
Logan, I want to ask then, if we get away maybe from the structural challenges right now, even just to the rules challenges, mm-hmm. there are folks on Democratic side, but also on the Republican side, including one who happens to sit at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, who think the challenge is the filibuster, some of the rules right now that prevent the system from working, and that could allow, if we are in a place where we're going to have a Senate that is always going to be pretty evenly divided, whether it's Democrats in charge or Republicans in charge, it can't work if you're asking for every vote to get two-thirds of folks to agree on something.
Well, so it's important to note, I think, that the filibuster is a, as you said, it's a rule. It is mm-hmm. not a written down in the Constitution. Right. It's not some sort of a founding principle of the Senate, although it is now, generally speaking, a long-term tradition. One of the things that you learn when you actually work in the Senate is that there's a little phone in the desk in every Senate office that's the hotline, and the phone will ring every once in a while, and you'll get this thing that says, the majority leader in conjunction with the minority leader asks unanimous consent to pass XY bill. And that's the hotline. And any senator has a chance to ring back and say, no, I object to that. We actually have to go through the regular process on this. It is not red, unfortunately, but it does. There is a real hotline that rings, and you hear a voice on the other end of it. And I think people would be surprised the amount of stuff that no one ever objects to. A lot of things get through the Senate. I mean, the Senate is, by its nature, of course, designed to slow down the legislative process, but it is not a place where nothing happens. And I think that, you know, the Republicans had a remarkably accomplished Senate over the course of the past 3 years in terms of passing through judges, in terms of passing things like massive tax reform, in terms of passing the First Step Act, which did a lot of reforms of the criminal justice system. And I think that a lot of people confuse the Senate isn't passing things I want it to with the Senate isn't passing anything. And I think that that's not a problem. People are allowed to believe whatever they want to believe, but I think it's more of a perception issue than it is in the actual amount of things that are going through the Senate on a legislative basis. And I will say that there's obviously always a concern in any governmental system about what Osita called the tyranny of the minority, but it's impossible to be tyrannical controlling one half of one third of the government. I mean, the Senate definitely is a place that empowers smaller states because, you know, the way that our government is structured, it was supposed to empower states as opposed to just larger populations. But it's not as if the Senate can, in and of itself, pass a new policy. You know, the Senate can't change a sort of the course of history by itself. It takes either cooperation with the executive branch, if you're talking about confirming judges or authorizing treaties, or it takes working with the House of Representatives in terms of passing major legislation. And so there's not a lot of risk that the Senate will somehow be able to take over America. And if you've met a lot of senators, you know that they're generally on the older front and probably wouldn't be able to run out front there.
Osita, do you expect that in the next few years or so, we will see ultimately that the filibuster is no longer in place?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on Democrats to ditch it if they do take the Senate in the next election. Whether they actually succumb to that pressure, I have no idea.
Osita Wenevu is a staff writer at The New Yorker. Logan Dobson is a Republican strategist at Targeted Victory. Thanks to you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, people, your turn. We've been asking a nuanced question here. Each state in the United States gets two senators, regardless of population size. Do you think that's fair? Why or why not?
Mary Madsen calling from Brooklyn, New York. It might be fair for each state to have two senators if there was a way to give the House more power so that the Senate can't block things that are supported by the majority of people. As it is, it seems like the states with very few people have too much power.
Hi, this is Charlie from Merritt Island, Florida. Absolutely not. The will of the people is not being represented equally. Why should a place like Wyoming or Utah, with very little diversity, both ethnically and politically, have equal weight against larger, more diverse, and denser cities?
Hi, I'm Tanya. I'm calling from Rochester, and I do not think that it's fair to have two senators, regardless of the size of our state, because with more people, there should be more representatives. There's more issues, more needs, which would require more time to cover these and to be informed and to be able to have the knowledge and the means to work with these concerns. So, no, I don't think that it's fair, and I think that we do need at least more representatives and senators if we're going to go about that route.
Our phone line is always open at Takeaway HQ. 877-8-MY-TAKE is the number, or tweet us at The Takeaway. All this hour, we have been talking about the Senate, and it's a place that, as you probably know, can get a little weird.
I do not like green eggs and ham. I do not like them. Sam, I am.
I asked the chair, you know what this is? It's a snowball.
Barbaric! Hear me! Barbaric!
And when things get hairy, the person in charge of keeping the order is someone you may not know even existed, the Senate parliamentarian. Currently, that's Elizabeth McDonough. And before her, it was Alan Fruman.
Hello.
Hey, Alan, it's Amy Walter. How are you?
I'm great. Very nice talking to you.
I asked him how he would describe the job, which he held on and off for nearly two decades up until 2012.
The parliamentarian is basically the referee in the Senate. He or she is the keeper of the rules and the precedents, and more significantly in this day and age, the keeper of the norms of behavior. But it's the person who, when everything is going well, nobody notices. And when all hell is breaking loose, everybody looks at the parliamentarian.
It seems that there are a number of members, most recently Bernie Sanders, saying the vice president can override the advice of the Senate parliamentarian. We can pass Medicare for all on a reconciliation. Doesn't matter what the parliamentarian says. That there's a sense that the rules now that have been set up have been thwarting progress. And that in order to have progress on major issues, we have to blow the system up.
Well, the rules have been thwarting progress by his definition. The rules have been protecting the integrity of the institution, and the rules have been guaranteeing some buy-in by those people in the country who are not part of the majority. I mean, to me, the idea that the Senate protects those who are not in power via the filibuster is enormously important. It's the only place in the federal government where people out of power are not powerless. And otherwise, you simply have a dictatorship of the majority. And I don't believe that's what the Founding Fathers had in mind. The Senate certainly can be criticized for being slow and inefficient, but in that inefficiency are meaningful protections for millions and millions of people who may not be on board with whatever the current majority's idea of progress happens to be. And they're entitled to be heard.
But so that seems to be the point now, is that we're not now at a time where there's a belief that, well, I'm in the majority now, but at any moment, I could be in the minority. So I want to make sure that we preserve these institutional norms that protect the minority.
Well, I certainly lament that trend. I agree with you that seems to be going away. And that's a terrible thing, because if the minority feels it's been abused, they will harbor a grudge. And when they become the majority, they will seek payback. And that's a death spiral of democracy.
I want to get to folks who have called in with some questions for you.
Sure.
Okay, let's start.
Hi, this is Kimo from Pittsburgh. My question is about reconciliation of a bill. I know that after a bill passes both houses, sometimes in different forms, that it needs to be reconciled. Who does this, and do the changes made during reconciliation sometimes affect a senator's support of the original bill?
Well, here we have the problem of the use of the word reconciliation. What the caller really is talking about is bills going to conference committees where the two houses need to agree to compromise language between the two bills. To answer the question, yes, conferees have wide latitude to agree to a compromised version of the measure that's gone into conference. And so your caller shouldn't be surprised to know that from time to time, things come out of conference that leave people scratching their heads wondering, how did that get in there? Now, there are rules that prohibit totally unrelated material from being added in conference. So there is a way of extracting material that is somewhat airdropped into the measure by the conferees. But for the most part, they have wide latitude.
This is Susan from Vashon Island, Washington. What are the pros and cons of the filibuster in supporting Democratic legislation, that is, in the United States Senate?
Well, you say supporting Democratic legislation, so you're talking about a situation where the Democrats are in the minority, and so the filibuster is the Democrats' friend. Over the years, for the most part, certainly during my sentient years, Democrats, generally liberals in particular, were very much opposed to the filibuster because progressive legislation was being frustrated. Well, now you have the Democrats, the Progressive Party, in the minority in the Senate, and the filibuster is designed to empower the Senate's minority to participate. So in this Congress, any chance that the Democrats have of affecting policy through legislation is enhanced by the Senate's filibuster. And I think it would be foolish for the Democrats to argue or support a destruction of the filibuster simply because they believe that in the next Congress, perhaps the Democrats will be in the majority.
Hi, this is Jay. I'm the director for politics with Amy Walter. And here's my question. What's the deal with voice votes? Why is that still a thing?
Well, the Senate does business the way it's always done business. The truth of the matter is roll call votes are really the only time during the week that the floor is the focus of all 100 senators. So it's a good opportunity for them to see each other, to talk to each other, and frankly, to argue pro and con for the measure that's being voted on. The House has electronic voting, and it's kind of cool to watch it. I'm sure you have when the scoreboards light up. But they have that because there are so many of them. From the standpoint of a deliberative body, it's much better to have the roll call taken manually and to have senators show up. Think of how much less dramatic John McCain's thumbs down would have been if he just pressed the button.
Plus, I love knowing, yes, who's the first one? Mr. Akaka, aye.
Mr. Akaka, Mr. Alexander, Ms. Ayotte.
It feels very like something that is a tradition, but also that you have to put your face to this vote.
Yep. You have to look a senator in the eye and say, I'm voting against your amendment. Just this one time, of course.
Of course, because we will work out our differences somewhere else.
Absolutely.
Alan Fruman, thank you so much for coming on and walking us through all of this.
Amy, it's been my pleasure.
Alan Fruman was the Senate parliamentarian from 1987 to 1995, and again from 2001 to 2012. Also a note to add here, Senator Daniel Akaka died last year at the age of 93. These days, the first senator called during roll call votes is...
The clerk will call the roll.
Mr. Alexander.
The debate about how the Senate works, or doesn't, is part of a bigger debate and a bigger issue that I've talked about a lot on the show. The breakdown of trust and faith in institutions. The whole deal in politics is that winners treat the losers fairly because they know that someday they will be on the losing side and want to be treated with respect and fairness. But that's not where we are now. Americans are more distrustful of the other party than ever before. But you see, changing the underlying structures of the system creates all kinds of unintended consequences that may only exacerbate the problems that they're trying to fix. Blowing up or reconstructing institutions like the Senate may solve a short-term problem, but in the longer term, our bigger problem that needs fixing is to find faith and trust in one another. That's all for us today. And of course, you can call us anytime at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet. I'm at Amy E. Walter, and the show is at The Takeaway. Thanks to WAMU for hosting us today, and thanks to you for listening. This is Politics with Amy Walter on The Takeaway.
Politics with Amy Walters brought to you by The Takeaway. Our senior producer is Amber Hall. Our associate producer is Lydia Jean Cott. Our director is Jay Cowett. Our engineer is Vince Fairchild. And our executive producer is Ellen Frankman. Remember, if you like this podcast, leave us a rating and review on iTunes. See you next week.